Hey, sports fans, Coach Nick here, and welcome to B-Ball Breakdown. I am very pleased to bring on Coach Jim Boone, the head coach of Delta State University in Cleveland, Mississippi, to talk basketball. Coach, thanks for joining us, and how is everything going so far as in preparation of next year's season?
Well, first of all, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you today, Nick, and secondly, it's going great. Couldn't be more excited about the future of our program and what we've accomplished up to this point, and looking forward to next season coming very quickly.
I can imagine it. You have no time to rest. Well, let's break into what I noticed was that you had played some when you were in your younger years. I'm kind of curious, what kind of a player were you back then? Were you a coach on the floor?
I was a good high school player on a very good high school team that was able to accomplish a great deal of success, particularly my senior year, and then went on to play college basketball at West Virginia State College, now West Virginia State University, and had a tremendous opportunity. I was not a good college player. I was a good teammate, a good guy to be there encouraging my team and helping my team, learned a ton about coaching. And I think there's a lot to be said that sometimes sitting on that bench is a great learning opportunity. And I played for a good man, Bob Maxwell. He gave me a lot of latitude in regards to listening and being in meetings and just being around him and what he was doing with our team and leading our team. And actually, very few people really remember this, but my senior year, I forewent the opportunity to play and served as a student assistant. And again, one of the most valuable learning experiences I've ever had. And fortunately, I worked for Coach Maxwell, who gave me tremendous, tremendous leeway to not only coach and be actively involved on the floor, but in scouting and just many of those on-court and strategy film-type opportunities that you usually don't get as a college senior. So that was a great start to my coaching career.
Do you find yourself still using actions or things that Coach Maxwell used when you were playing for him?
Probably don't use nearly as much. I think that when you start to look at your background and what you do, probably the person that had the greatest effect or persons that have had the greatest effect on my coaching career, Alan Osborne, who is the head high school coach at Polka High School in Polka, West Virginia. His team this year went 26-0, won the AA state championship, and is a big pack line defensive team. Coach Osborne was my freshman coach in high school and someone that after I left high school and joined the college ranks, I became very good friends with. We would go to various clinics across the country, and one of the people that we enjoyed following the most, studying the most, and learning the most from was Bob Knight. So I probably take a greater amount of what we do in our program today from Bob Knight, from Dick Bennett, and from Don Meyer. Those three individuals and a little bit of Coach Majerus have probably influenced me more than any other area or any other entities, individuals in my coaching career. And in all cases, I had a tremendous opportunity. I worked Coach Knight's camp for about six straight summers. Some of those as the head coach at California University of Pennsylvania. Tremendous learning opportunity in those days. Sometimes it's hard for me to fathom in today's world that we actually ran camp for five straight days. And I mean, you were working from 6 a.m. until midnight. Coach Bennett, who opened his program to me and allowed me to come in and study and watch, Mike Heideman, who was one of Coach Bennett's, assistants at Green Bay, who then took the Green Bay job, learning from him. Don Meyer, who became a great friend and someone that I learned tremendously from, going to his practices, his academies, and just getting to know him on a personal level. And And it certainly, as I mentioned last, Coach Majerus, who I think is one of the great teachers of all time, just sharing his thoughts and learning from him. So we all do that. We take a compilation of so much that we steal from, take from, whatever words you want to use, to create our own philosophies and who we are as coaches. And lastly, I would say that, you know, the opportunity to become a head coach at such a young age, where the practices, the games were actually my laboratory. I was learning on the fly and developing who I was as a coach and my own philosophy, garnering what I had learned from those individuals I just mentioned.
Wow. Well, that's a lot of luminaries in the field for sure. You know, a really funny note was that my mentor, who I was an assistant to before I took over the program in L.A., used moving the direction is the most important thing on defense, not staying between your man and the ball. It's moving the direction of the ball. And I somehow convoluted that idea that it was a Bobby Knight thing that he had learned when he went to Indiana. And it was funny because the other day I was talking to him about it, and he goes, no, that's not Bobby Knight. That was some guy who coached in the Valley in L.A. in the 70s he got that from. And I was like, what was funny was that my whole impression of how Bobby Knight taught defense kind of shattered, in at my feet. Now, that said, I do want to talk about pack line defense because you mentioned it, and you mentioned Coach Bennett. And my first introduction to it, when I was a manager at Wisconsin, we played against UW-Green Bay. And I remember Stu Jackson was, as we were breaking it down, basically said, he goes, you're going to be able to swing the ball around that perimeter and you're going to think this is awesome. We got great ball movement. This is amazing. And next thing you know, there's 5 seconds of the shot clock and you have to burp up a bad shot. And that was it. That was my first introduction to pack line. Now, does that sound familiar to you?
Very familiar. And that, Coach Jackson certainly hit that right on the head that's kind of what we do. And you know, one of the things that we constantly emphasize to our team and the coaches who want to employ the pack line defense is that closeouts are of paramount importance. You're going to have an inordinate amount of closeouts during the course of a game because we are allowing the ball to freely move outside of the scoring area on the perimeter. You know, when I first started coaching as a head coach, there was not a shot clock, and offenses were primarily more east-west in terms of how they were set up. It was about ball reversal, move the defense, patience, work to get a good shot. And slowly what evolved was the dribble became so much a greater part of the game than passing, cutting, and moving. And so therefore the game became more of a north-south type of situation. So our defense evolved. You know, at one point we were definitely an on the line, up the line, deny, fight for every inch of the court, do not allow you to reverse the ball. Reversing the ball, allowing an offense to reverse the ball freely was a bad thing. We wanted to do our best to take that away. But as what we found out is that by doing that, we were actually creating offense for the offensive team because of our pressure was creating dribble penetration. It was creating help and recovery situations that we could not get back to shooters upon stopping the ball. And probably I was at California University of Pennsylvania for 10 years, and I'd say probably in our eighth or ninth year, we really started toying around with trying to do something that would be better served to take away dribble penetration. We still denied reversal, but we didn't deny the ball to the wing as much as we had the first entry pass. And then as I left Cal, I took the job at Robert Morris University, then Robert Morris College, a small Division I competing in a Northeast Conference. And we inherited a team that was coming off of, I can't remember, but 4 or 5 losing seasons. And frankly, we had a great group of guys, but we were not very good basketball players. I knew there was no way we could go into that situation and survive have any opportunity to win whatsoever in building the program and trying to get out and deny freshman basketball. So what I did is we were in the opening parts of practice, the opening week or so, and I told our coaches, I'm going to drive out to Madison. Coach Bennett was in his second year at the University of Wisconsin. And I'm going to see if I can spend some time with Coach Bennett and learn a little bit more about how we can be a better defensive team with what we have. And Coach Bennett was very gracious in allowing me to do that. We practiced with our team on a Thursday morning at 6 in the morning, and I got in my car and I drove to Madison. I watched Friday afternoon's practice. I watched Saturday. I believe they went twice on Saturday, and I was able to watch a Sunday practice before getting home late Sunday night and starting up with our ideas of what we had learned in regards to the pack line defense on that Monday. And since that time, through our study and through the evolution of us utilizing the pack line, which we have ever since that date, I feel like we've been able to put our own twist on it, how we want to defend. And we have a very definitive methodology in terms of how we teach our pack line defense, and it's been really, really good for us. So we made the total metamorphosis from what you and I began this discussion with in regards to the ball being reversed freely, where at one point we didn't want that to happen, where now that's fine. We just want to keep you from the biggest deal with this thing, and a lot of coaches always talk about this. I think there are three major keys in understanding and teaching, developing the pack line defense. And when we speak at clinics and I work with our own team, these are three things that we try to really bring to the forefront. The first one being the myth, and I believe there's a great myth out there that the pack line defense is a sloughing, soft, no pressure defense. And that could be as far from the truth as it is. We want to be a really tough, blue collar, hard nosed, grit and grind defense, but it is imperative that you have ball pressure. If you allow, you know, a Peyton Manning to drop back and have no pressure, not to be moved off his spot, so to speak, he's going to pick you apart. You've got to get him moving. You've got to make him uncomfortable. And that's what we're trying to do with our ball pressure within the limitations of who we are and who we're defending individually. We want as much pressure as we can without losing containment. So that's the number one thing, is that we have pressure on the ball. The second thing is that your non-ball defenders are already positioned and health. In other words, a good way to say that is your positioning is your health. When, as we talked about, when I first started coaching and we were up the line, on the line, we denied, we helped, and we recovered. We don't think you can do all three of those things. You know, the great Hall of Fame coach Chuck Daly always said that it's not the help that beats you, it's the recovery that gets you beat. So what we've tried to do is eliminate the denial part of it. We don't have a help and recovery mode because now we're already positioned in help. And all we have to do is recover to our man. So that's the second thing. And I think the last thing is to understand offenses are going to get shots. And it's not, we're not trying to prevent you from getting a shot. What we're trying to do is influence the type of shot you get. And our goal, and this is kind of where I started this at, our goal is to, when you talked about you're able to reverse the ball easily and change it from side to side, that's okay. Our goal is that we want to influence you to take contested twos, not open threes, and certainly not layups, but contested jump shots. If we can get you to do that, then we're doing our job.
Well, I make a big deal on my show, on my channel, about no middle defense. A is the one big one, which I think, pack line, is what you're saying, is we don't want middle penetration. Would that be safe to say?
Well, we don't want to. In the pack line, one of our, we have a series of things we call no, K-N-O-W, your nose, N-O-S, know your nose. And it's not just important that we know them as coaches. It's more important that our players understand our nose. One of our nose is no baseline. We are absolutely adamant that we will not get beaten to the outside. We cannot give up baseline. Now, with that being said, we do not force the ball mental into the middle. You may say that's semantics. No, it's not. We're not going to get beat baseline. That is your first priority. But we're not just giving up a middle drop. So therefore, if the ball is on the wing, we are more square in regards to our positioning on that wing with our back, our spine pointed to the rim. Well, we're not forcing you middle to take away baseline, but we understand we're not going to give up baseline. So then you say, well, why such an emphasis on not giving up the baseline? It's twofold. Number one, it starts with how we guard the post. We're going to guard anyone who's in the low post, and we believe there are only two positions on the court to defend, the low post, and then everyone else is a perimeter. The low post is designated by a post box that we put, which is really a rectangle. It goes about a couple feet above the block and goes across the court and maybe extends outside the lane line about a foot, 18 inches. If you're in that rectangle, if you're in that low post box, then you are considered a low post player. We prefer to guard a low post player three-quarter denial on top. Now, we don't allow passes into the pack. We don't care if you go around the pack. The pack line is 16 feet from the basket. So inside that 16-foot arc, we do not allow you to freely pass the ball because that's putting the ball into the scoring area. But that's where all of our non-ball defenders are located. So we're three-quarter on top on the post. If we allow you to drive a baseline, we're not going to have a helper there. If you're a team that forces baseline, you're probably going to front or you're going to go from high side to low side on the post so you have a helper, or you're going to come from across the court with the lowest forward or helper in the lane to stop that drive. We don't want that kind of rotation because what happens to us and what we saw happening a lot when we were a team that pressured and forced at baseline was that when you rotate across the floor to help on the post player who has now stopped the ball on the baseline drive, and you rotate down to help the helper, inevitably, I've got my 5'11", 6', 6'1" guard who's rotating down conceivably to defend and block out your 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", forward. And we as coaches, oh, block him out. You can't let... Well, he's trying. He can't, and he's not going to win that battle. It evolves into fouls, which that's another no fouls. It evolves into offensive rebounding, which is another one of our no-your-nos, no second shots. And so, therefore, we want to maintain our best defenders as per your personnel as an offensive team. And I want my big guy blocking out your big guy, not my smaller guard attempting to block out your big guy. So we don't want to give up the baseline drives to avoid rotations and because of how we defend the post. But again, we're not just allowing you to drive the ball to the middle.
I like that. I mean, you know, you have a good point. It's funny. When I would watch Magic Johnson play for the Lakers in the 80s, and I know the pros are a lot different, but the advantage that no one ever talks about was what you just described, which is when they had to sink and fill and help, it's not your point guard. Well, it is their point guard who's sliding down, but the dude is 6'9 and strong and big. And it was like a total advantage that no one ever sort of realized. And so... I guess you are right because, you know, the way I always would do it, and I like to, you know, KISS, keep it simple, stupid. I try and keep it as streamlined as possible. So to me, it was no middle was a big one. And obviously, the help has to come from the lowest guy slides over, right, and the farthest guy slides down. But that actually leads me to my next question because I get into it with a couple of coaches who are a little bit older than I am and who come from, you know, maybe more of your era who played or who coached in the early 80s. And which is helping one pass away. And for me, that would be the number one know your no, is do not help one pass away. I feel even at the high school level, if I drive and the guy helps from one pass away, it's the easy play to make to kick it out for the three and the guy gets an open shot. But I've been hearing that pack line sort of, you know, helps one pass away, but I don't know if that's exactly accurate. So what's your take on that?
Well, again, it comes back to the second tenet that we discussed, and that is your non-ball defenders are already in help. And for the very reason that you just alluded to, you don't want to help from one pass away and how you have your defense set up. And I understand that, because now if I come to help and my momentum is all coming to stop the ball, and now the ball handler picks up his dribble to pass it, I have to change momentum, change direction, and work to get back to my man and recover. And in my mind, at this juncture in my coaching career, that is an impossibility. You can't do those three things. You can't deny, come to help, and then recover. You're going to give up open threes. Another one of our know your no's is no rhythm threes. We don't want you to be able to step into it and shoot it. I get asked this question constantly. Do you give up a lot of open threes? Does your opponent shoot a high percentage from three? We consistently lead our league, or we're at least in the top one or two in our league, on a yearly basis in our three-point field goal percentage defense. Because our guys are already in help, your position is your help. I'm in the gap. As the ball is driven at me, I'm not moving to the ball. I'm already there. So I only have one direction to go, and that is to recover to my man, my assignment. So we've eliminated, we call it that false movement, that momentum it takes us to the ball, and now we have to change direction and go. We've eliminated that. And therefore, we can get to the shooter much quicker to contest the shot. Now, with that being said, the one area that we are that will change up a little bit as per scouting report and personnel is how we close out. And again, closeouts are the biggest and most important thing that we do. We will close out as per what your skill level is. I like to name them in terms of our closeouts. We used to just say we're straight up, dead three, or driver. Players love to hear the NBA connotation to it, so we use NBA names. Straight up is a complete play. That's Kobe. So that's a Kobe closeout for us. We prefer to be within a finger touch, where we can both contest a shot but take away the drive. A driver, that's a Rondo closeout. We want to be hard and very short. He can't beat us with the perimeter jump shot. In fact, if he wants to shoot that one, we're happy with him shooting that one. If he makes one, that's the best thing that can happen, because there's five more coming he's going to miss. We just want to be in position to take away the drive. And the dead three is a Ray Allen closeout, because he's a guy you cannot allow to catch and shoot. So we've got to get off. We've closed out long right into the Ray Allen closeout, right up under his chin, and make him put the ball on the floor. Do not allow him to catch and shoot and have a rhythm three. So while we're already in our help, we understand who we're guarding. That's why we do not like the switch. When I was, again, our first 8-9 years, because we were a pressure team that forced it baseline and denied, we switched there. Anything that was off ball, we switched. And particularly if it was like men, 1-2-3 or 4-5, we would switch that. Well, the problem being, now I'm guarding you, and you're a Rondo closeout because all you can do is drive it. And now I switch onto a Ray Allen that I've got to take off the line, and then I switch again and I'm guarding Kobe. It's really hard, I believe, and I like your terminology, KISS, when you're keeping it simple. It's really hard for a player in the heat of the battle to be able to conceptualize that I'm going from one dramatic situation to another. I want to maintain the integrity of our matchups. I want my best driver, defender, guarding your best driver. I want my best defensive player guarding your Kobe closeout man, the guy that is a complete player and can shoot it and drive it. And I want my best guy getting in and taking you off the dribble or forcing you off the line, making you dribble, guarding your shooter. By maintaining the integrity of our assignments, our matchups, and our closeouts, I think it makes us a much stronger defensive unit.
You know, I really, what's funny is that I'm picturing, as playing, moving in direction of the ball, which basically means, for those who don't know out there, for every pass that's made, if you're off the ball, we have a very distinct pattern of footwork that you take to move your body in that direction. And you don't have to worry about where you need to be on the weak side because it kind of takes you there as long as you execute the fundamental footwork. However, what I would have to train is if you're one pass away, if I'm guarding the ball and he passes it, we move in a direction so he can't cut over the top, which I'd imagine you guys do something like that. But then to get back, it used to be denial, right? You get back, you move in a direction so he can't beat you, and then you take another step and now you're denying. But I would have to show my kids at the high school level that denying the pass doesn't mean that your hand has to be in the passing lane physically. And I would show them, I'm sure you know, like I'd say, okay, he's going to throw it. If he threw it now and you're one step behind, can you deflect it? And the guy goes, and he does it. He can deflect it. Now take a half step more. And then eventually each one figures out how far back they can be. But guess what I just realized I was doing? I think I'm doing pack line because most of those players can kind of be denial or deflecting the pass back to their man and still be in the position that you're talking about to close out or not even let the offensive player see the lane to drive.
I agree totally. And what happens is a lot of people are running a hybrid type of defense that incorporates a lot of pack line principles. But think about how more effective your defense can be if you go wholesale pack line and teach the techniques and the fundamentals of being a very good pack line defense. It's almost that thing where you're trying to deny and you can't deny. You're trying to be in the gap to take away the drive, but you're not really in the gap. You're trying to recover to your man, but you're not sure just exactly how to do it. And we call it being in no man's land because you're not doing either one. You're not denying. You're not in the pack. And that's not a good place to be.
Also, I think that players at all levels get a little bit convoluted with, and we could talk about language that coaches use as well. Talking about playing as hard as you can and playing for a team. When I was a player, and I played like good high school, and that was about it, but, I remember just being someone who played almost too hard to the point where I was wasting so much energy. And I feel like what you're talking about with the pack line is you can be much more effective and be much more efficient with your energy to take things away. The game actually becomes easier than when you try and play hard. And a lot of times I talk about it where if players want to play hard, you can't shoot the ball harder, right? You can't really pass the ball harder or dribble it harder. That's why the specificity of language to me is really important because it's not about that. It's about maybe your footwork being more efficient or getting to your spot, on balance quicker, I think. This is a strange, concept, but I'm wondering if you recognize what I'm trying to say.
Well, I think you can go back to Coach John Wooden, and he had a great quote that takes that totally into context of what you're talking about, and that's don't mistake activity for achievement. I don't think you can put a ceiling on playing too hard. I love guys that play too hard, but I know exactly what you're saying. You're playing too hard, but you're misdirected in how you play. And again, to quote Coach Wooden, don't mistake activity for achievement. So what we've done is we still have to be very active in our gaps. We call it get your motor running. We want those feet moving. We want them active so that they're ready to stop the ball, to close out. And you've really got to be focused on the ball. I mean, you've really got to be clued in on the ball. As soon as that second hand starts coming to the ball, we are constantly repositioning because one of the tenets of being in the pack is that we want to be able to see both man and ball at all times. So to see our man and to see the ball, we have to constantly reposition as our man moves and the ball moves. You can't just stand and think that you're in a good position. You're constantly repositioning where you're at within the pack.
Let me ask you this about closeouts, because a newer fundamental, particularly in the NBA, which, you know, has elite athletes, is leaving your feet to run the three-point shooter off. But remember, what we see a lot of the better teams like the Bulls do is the fundamental isn't just you jump in the air and then you end up out of bounds. You can see them, and I've heard this being taught, where you teach them how to land correctly so that they're already turned facing the court again and they are sprinting right back in. It's not a wasted jump out of bounds and you're no longer in the play. Do you teach that?
No, we do not. And I don't like that fly-by closeout. And I think it is a good thing for what the NBA is doing in regards to how they run at players. We want to close out under control and keep the ball in front of us. And we have a term that we call seeking leverage. To use your imagination, say that you are guarding a player on the wing and the ball is at the top. And so now in your pack, inside the pack, in your defensive gap, you're probably just above and just off of the elbow on the lane line. And now as the ball's driven and he passes the ball, the ball handler who drives it at you passes the ball to the wing, who probably slid down a step or two. If you run directly from your gap position to the ball handler, you are now at such a poor angle of recovery, you are inviting the baseline drop. And again, remember, no baseline. So our first point is to seek leverage, to try to get lower than the ball before we close out to the ball. So that's a one or two steps towards the baseline and then close out. Now we'll exaggerate that in practice to the point where you're saying, wow, you can't even get there. But it's kind of the old philosophy of over-teaching something, because you're going to have a degree of slippage in actual competition. And so we seek leverage, we close out high hands. We're going to sprint the first 2 to 3 steps. The last couple steps to 3 steps are going to be choppy steps, weight back, high hands. That's very imperative. We want the high hands to discourage a shot, at least give the illusion that there is not a shot available, potentially to deflect a pass. But we want the feet moving, the weight back, and your body in such a way that you're ready to absorb any dribble penetration. And by seeking leverage, we again are squared up and we do not give up a baseline drive.
Well, you know, since we have some time to talk a little bit about some of the really detailed stuff, you know, I certainly learned the closeout at Wisconsin with Coach Jackson and Stan Van Gundy, which was the stuttered jump stop, where as you close out, both of your feet together are hopping at him. I've always believed that was the better way to do it. Now, I heard you say choppy steps. Do you teach left, right, left, right, left, right as you're closing out?
We do. And here's the beauty of our game, as you well know, is that there are 100 different ways to go about it. And the best way is the way that works for you. And I think the most important thing is that if you're going to, whatever way you decide to teach, that it is a system and that it is consistent and everything fits. And I'm sure the way that you learned to close out at Wisconsin with Coach Jackson and with Coach Van Gundy, who's outstanding, would fit how you played the entirety of your defense. For us, yes, it's probably more of a left, right, but it's just real quick, wide stance. Again, weight back, insides of your feet, high hands, elbows bent, hands between shoulders, fingers to the ceiling. We're very exact in how we want our closeouts to occur.
Exactly. I mean, it's funny because I brought another guy who coached in Europe. He's an American guy, but he coached in Europe, and he's got a lot of interesting takes on things because they do a lot of things differently there. And he's published 2 books, and maybe you've even heard of him, called Fake Fundamentals. And so this just quickly reminds me of some things about closeouts and certain things that we do. I'm kind of curious in your take. You know, in the first book, he talks about like the three-man weave, for instance, and how there really isn't any real game connection to running a three-man weave and then anything you might ever do on the court. Yeah, we all have done it for all these years. And I know this is a bit of an interesting segue, but let's talk a little bit about that because, I mean, you know, after coaching for as long as you have, do you feel like you're set in your ways and this is how we're going to go down, we're going to ride that ship down with it? Or are you always sort of looking at things and seeing if there are different ways to do them?
I think you've got to have your philosophy and your core and how you want to play the game. With that being said, then you need to really work to stay fresh, to stay current, to understand the changes that are evolving in the game. For us, I think that's probably affected us more offensively than defensively. We've played the pack now for, I guess, going on 19 years. This year will be the 19th year that we've played the pack line defense. And we're a motion offense team, but we have changed how we've approached our motion and how we've ran it. And we're always tinkering with it as per the game, how the game's being played, how the rules are changing. And we're going to see a dramatic rule change this year with the 30-second shot clock in college basketball. And certainly, I think that's going to be a very strong rule change for our defense. It's going to make our defense better. I mean, theoretically, we're going to be playing defense for 24 seconds now, probably at max, unless it's a, you know, reset in the half-court area because of a foul or what have you. So, yes, you're always trying to stay current. We're always looking for new ways. And I do like what you said. I think one of the areas that when I first started coaching, I was very deficient in, and that was studying the NBA game. There's a lot to be learned from the NBA game, and we have learned. We've really tried to do a much better job of learning, studying, and appreciate the level, the intensity, and the amount of teaching and decision-making that goes on at that level from a coaching perspective. And it is intense. So we've learned a lot from that.
You know, speaking of the NBA, and like, you know, we do a lot of breakdowns. We talk a lot about ice defense of the pick and roll, which, you know, blue, ice, or whatever you want to call it. It's funny because it kind of seems like it plays into your philosophy anyway. You'd almost, well, I'm not even sure, because I guess the prevalence now of pick and roll at the college level has probably made you adjust your defense as well. So how does the pack line deal with a sideline screen and roll that you might see a lot more now?
Well, we do not ice it or blue it. We've called it downing it. We do not down it where we force the ball to the baseline away from the screen. And the reason being is because no baseline. We played with that 3 years ago in downing ball screens early in our season. I love the concept. It takes the ball screen out of the play. But I felt it was something that was diametrically opposed, at least philosophically, and the inconsistency in the teaching to tell our team and constantly preach to our team, no baseline. Now all of a sudden we're forcing it baseline and putting our big in a position to help on that drive. So we guard all side ball screens in a hard show with a hard hedge, if you will, with our screener defender and our ball defender. The biggest thing, Nick, we try to do is maintain consistency in all that we do teaching. We want to guard all screens primarily the same. So in our ball screens with our ball defender, we always make the ball use the screen because that's putting the ball in a position where we do have help. So we use these terms with our ball defender: body up, body in, body over. Body up, get up into the ball, force it to the screen. Body in, if you're away from the ball, you're trying to, if you've got space between you and the ball, you become a screen magnet. You're going to run right into the screen. You're easily screened. So we want to be into the ball. And body over, the majority of the screens that we defend, we want to get over top of the screen with our ball defender. Mm-hmm. And so in the side ball screen, we're getting over the screen with the ball defender, but under our screener defender. our screener defender, his basic premise is to stay with the ball for two dribbles and force it out towards half court or for the ball to be picked up, and then we'll recover. Now, there are some issues with that. You know, if you have, because again, we want to be able to force you into contested twos, so it does come down to a personnel decision on what you do well with the ball screen and what my defender can do in regards to his abilities. So some of ball screens on the side will guard level show, where we're more in a parallel path with the baseline in the screen with our screener defender. We're still getting over top of the screen with our ball defender, but our screener defender is in a much better position now to recover to a pick and pop or to a roll. But that's our two base ways of defending the side ball screen, hard show or level show.
Fair enough. You know, it's funny because Ice was very effective for a couple of years in the NBA level as well. And then the Spurs, I think, were the ones who kind of figured it out, and probably the European influence they have. You know, they'd set the inside ball screen on the wing and then they would force him away. So all they would do, you could picture Diaw, would just turn and now become a flat ball screen, you know, parallel to the baseline. And now you're still screening that guard who was trying to force you away from the screen in the first place. And then they snake dribble, you know, the guy will use the screen and then he goes right by the big. So it's been a real interesting give and take and back and forth between the offense and the defense and the adjustments. I love that stuff. I wonder, are you starting to see at your level that kind of screening where he sets up one way and then quickly turns to make it a different kind of screen?
Yes, and we call that the step-up ball screen, the step-up ball screen. And there's a couple different things that we see out of that and that we've even incorporated in our use in our motion offense versus teams that down the ball screen or ice the ball screen on the side. You can, if the player is a very good shooter, we set the step up and we pick and pop. That's a hard, you know, you're asking a big to stop the ball on a baseline drive, and because you've screened the ball defender by setting the step up screen, mm-hmm. and now recover back. And so you're going to have to stunt with other players to create that help while he's recovering. The second thing is, if he's a guy that can't shoot it, we roll him to the rim. And now when he rolls to the rim and the screener defender recovers to him, he's in front. And if we can flash another person into the high post area, we have a top-down, high-low feed that's available to us. And those have been our two most effective ways of countering the down or the ice, if you will, other than being able to split it. You called it a snake move, which I like that, but to split it with our ball defender or our ball handler. And sometimes you have a ball handler who's really good at that, really creative with the ball, that can really hurt the defense, because now he's gotten into the lane, into the interior of the defense, and created a lot of problems.
Absolutely. It's again fascinating. And let's talk about your offense a little bit, because I know, you know, when coaches get together, we talk about probably defense more, maybe not, but it sounds like, you know, I'm sure the audience would want to hear about something about offense. So you're running Bobby Knight's off. Is that, are you doing Bobby Knight motion?
We've kind of got our own twist on it. We've incorporated a lot of things from Coach Knight. I think he is one of the best teachers ever. So we've incorporated a lot of what he does. We've taken a little bit of the blocker mover concepts from Coach Bennett. Just in regards to screeners understanding that's their primary role, is to screen and get your cutter open. The one thing I don't like to hear is when people say, well, that's all I am, is a screener. No, you're never just a screener. The screener is probably the most viable weapon in a screen, off-ball screen scenario, because the defense has to help on the cutter if that cutter makes a good hard cut and is a good scorer. So we've incorporated a little bit of both of those. We do run alignments, whether it be pairs where we have two designated screeners and three cutters, or it's triangle. We've got three guys working kind of in the pack area to screen and cut and get open with two feeders. or it's a regular, which is our four out, one in, where we have one dominant post player working on the inside and four perimeters around him, or it's post exchange, where we're working with three feeders and two guys working kind of in the pack area to screen and cut and get open. And our alignment changes as per our personnel. And so every year we're going to have a primary alignment and a couple of secondary options to go to so that we can play against whatever defense you throw at us. But with that being said, it's amazing, Nick, you start a season and you really think, okay, this is the alignment that's going to be really good for our team. And by February, you're doing something totally different because basketball teams evolve and your ability to change. And I always say this, we don't try to take a guy and do the proverbial round peg in the square hole. We want our offense to wrap around our players' abilities and talents. We don't want it to be the other way around. We're going to fit an offense around the talents of our players. And that's why it constantly is an evolving dynamic scenario.
You know, a lot of coaches like the idea, especially when they're beginning their coaching career and they don't have a philosophy yet and they're trying to – I get emails all the time, should I begin? And certainly I'm a triangle offense coach, which is motion. I think we're all sort of brothers in the motion family. The question then is if you want to do a read and react offense, which basically is what Bobby Knight does, it sounds like, well, certainly in movers and blockers there's a lot of read and react. How – it's the first day of practice, and you want to start to teach the players how to do this. And unfortunately, I think back in the day, there were a lot more fundamentals that were just sort of ingrained. You and I probably growing up, just, you know, if the ball went to the high post, you always cut to the basket. Like, that was just a thing. And no one ever taught it, and we've lost that kind of, right, that instinct. However, so the question is, and I guess this goes into what I always ask coaches, is are you a part method or a whole method coach? And is there an easy, succinct way to kind of explain that without going into a huge discussion about how you begin to teach a read and react style offense?
We are whole part in terms of our teaching. I guess to quote Coach Knight, part, whole part. We think it's important that the fundamentals that we teach fit into what we're doing offensively. So in the beginning of the year, when we're doing a lot more individual instruction, which we'll do throughout the year, but we really focus in on that our first month of practice in August and September, we're teaching all the components of our offense. But we do take our team in and we walk them through in terms of whole method. Here's how our offense should look. Here's what we do. Here's how you get open. Here's how you screen. This is how we run our offense. We'll do that, and then we'll go three-quarter speed and kind of jog through it with the defense so that we can see this is how you read this screen. This is the cut you should have made. And obviously, film has been an incredible resource and tool for us in teaching motion offense. But I do agree with you that, you know, today players are so much more in tune to one guy coming off of a ball screen and three guys standing and watching, as opposed to all five guys moving, cutting, and working together. So we have incorporated, because it's something that players do from an early age, ball screening in our offense, and that has been very, very effective. But to answer your question and to summarize quickly, we start by teaching fundamentals, we show them the whole, and then we break it down on a daily basis from there.
You know, it's interesting because as a triangle coach, you know, people always want to say it's complicated and it's really hard. And I was able to teach it from the ninth grade level through to the varsity level. And I was always part. And it was funny because Tex Winter and I, Tex was sort of a mentor of mine when he was with the Lakers and helped. We would argue because he would say, no, it's whole, part, whole. And I would say, well, I don't want to show him the whole because I feel like that might be just too much to grab in one bite. So here's the thing. I have a lot more time than an NBA coach does, right? I have all fall to be able to slowly develop this, where I would imagine you don't have that time in the NBA. But what I would do is I would do two line drills, right? In little sections of our offense, piece by piece. And eventually they get bored with them. And that's when I knew they knew it, right? But I did notice that it would take a little bit longer to get. And then eventually the light bulb would go off. When we're doing 5-on-0, I would say, okay, remember 2 weeks ago when we did the two-line drill? That's this part. And they would say, oh, now I get it. So it would take a little bit longer. I wouldn't do defense either for a while. But now I'm starting to realize that, you know, all of my teams start out slow in the season. Now they get much better at the end of the year, which is what you want. But they always started out slow in the beginning of the season through the end. And then they would always start out slow to start the game. And I started to wonder that maybe I'm doing it wrong. Maybe I should be doing two-line drills and maybe very quickly do 2-on-0, but get to 2-on-2 and then 3-on-3 and 4-on-4 with live so they can begin to make those decisions much more quickly with a defensive player on him than just going through the motions of 4-on-0. What are your thoughts on that?
I would agree with the latter of what you just described, and I do think that it's imperative that you do start from day one with 5-on-0 and even 5-on-5 so that they can see. That way, when you're teaching the part, the 2-on-0, the 2-on-2, the 3-on-3, the 3-on-0, they have an understanding of how it fits into the big picture. And I think that's really important. And then for us, even though, and I know this is always a battle with coaches who teach a conceptual offense, a motion offense, that, well, they have to understand how to screen and cut before we can go 5-on-5. Well, I think it's more important that they're learning how to make decisions, even if they're not the right decisions, that initially, that they're learning how to space and maintain spacing, and they're learning how to move and coordinate that movement together. And the only way to do that is 5-on-5. They're going to make mistakes. They're not going to set screens at the proper angle. They're not going to make the cut you want to the pinch post. They're not going to do those things that we're teaching, but they're learning how to play, and they're learning how to play with each other. And as we then throw the parts in and constantly drill those on a daily basis, then you start to see them evolve into your 5-on-5. And that's one of the wonderful things of coaching, when you can see what you're teaching being applied in a competitive game situation.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I guess you're watching the metamorphosis of my philosophy right here live on screen, because I think you're right. I think, you know, that even the, maybe Tex, obviously Tex Winter knew a lot more than I did about it. And it worked. I was able to make it work. But I do feel like you're right. There's definitely needs to be more of that. Do you ever notice this at the college level, where you can run something 5-on-0 and the second you put the defense on it, like at least at my level, the high school level, all heck breaks loose for a little while, right? And they don't get anywhere near where they just done it like a second ago, right? Does that ever happen at your level?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Defense, pressure changes everything. And that's why I think it's really important from day one that you're going 5-on-5.
Well, let's finish off our discussion with something I talk about all the time, and you might see on Twitter, which is shooting the jump shot. You know, I was a strict 1-2 coach. And again, I'm not sure exactly how deep you're getting into the mechanics, but at the college level. But I was 1-2 because I believe that the hop was a jump stop. It was too slow. It took too long. Then I guess I saw the proverbial light, and I started to watch some of the guys that would hop. And I realized that I thought it was the way to go, certainly on many situations, and talking about spot ups. So here's my question. Are you a 1-2 or a hop coach?
We're 1-2, and particularly on the 3, and for a lot of different reasons. And we call it plant step. You know, we're planting our non-shooting foot to catch and stepping into the shot with our shooting hand foot to shoot it. I think less knee inflection is better. The hop produces a little bit more knee inflection. Less knee inflection creates a quicker shot, but you have to get your legs into it, and that's what the 1-2 step allows you to do. I know that at the NBA level, they like to teach a lot of the hop, and it's because you've got to get up quickly and higher on your shot. I'm not as concerned with that. I want to shoot open shots. I do not want to shoot pressured shots. So we're a 1-2 team, 1-2 step.
And so you don't feel that it's slower, or I guess you're not having 6'8" guys who have a 7-foot wingspan closing out on your shooters. Is that like the reason why? Because I guess the question then is, do you feel like the 1-2 is as fast as the hop when you're shooting it?
It may not be as quick, but I'm willing to give up that in return for having a consistent shot on both sides of the floor that is executed the same way every time when we're open.
Are you inside foot pivot all the time?
No, we have a permanent pivot.
Ah.
We teach a permanent pivot. So our non-shooting foot, in other words, I'm a right-handed player, so my left foot is always my pivot foot. Again, we think it really, and that's for our perimeter players, obviously. In the post, we're going to use either foot. But on the perimeter, it really helps us. Again, we're shooting the same shot, whether I'm moving right to left or left to right. I'm still planting my left, stepping in with my right as a right-handed shooter. And now on the catch, I've really put it down to three very simple moves. Either a direct drive, which I go by you right-handed, or a crossover, which I cross over and go by you left-handed, or a shot fake, which I then will execute either a direct or crossover. So rather than having this menagerie of moves I've got to worry about, I've only got three things I can do: direct drive, crossover, or shot fake. And with that being said, by having a permanent pivot foot, we have found that it really eliminates the travel. And one of our things that we do not want to do is turn the ball over. Sureness is at the top of our list of the three anchors that we employ in our program. And we're going to do a great job of working not to turn the ball over.
It's funny. It's very easy for me to agree with everything you said about the shooting, because I was the exact same way for over a decade of me teaching at my level. Permanent pivot foot. You know, Paul Pierce scores 20 a game in the NBA with his left foot pivot foot entirely. And then, you know, I don't know. I really started looking at it, and I realized that there were some benefits to the hop. I'm actually, here's what would happen if a guy shows up, a player as a freshman shows up in your program, and he's a hop shooter. Would you make him go to 1-2?
We're very demanding and very adamant about our footwork in shooting the basketball. We allow some leeway in other areas for shooting the ball, because everybody has a little bit different technique, and everybody's body is different. Everybody's learned differently. If we have a guy who's just really good at shooting off the hop, we may allow him to do that. But overall, we're teaching the 1-2 step. Now, what we do get into, and we call it a pro hop, is any time that we penetrate into paint, into the scoring area, and we're finishing a dribble, then we'll allow him to come to a jump stop, as you indicated, and shoot off of 2 feet in that manner. And that's just common sense.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, there's a guy who I met in Northern California who coaches the girls and has won state championships all over the place, and we've done some videos with him. And you know, one day maybe you can look at it, because I feel like when you see – I've been watching some of these guys work out. I know some of them are pros in the summers, but when I start watching them off the dribble and they scissor their feet together to go up off the dribble, for instance – which is a hop, right? They kind of get up in the air and they bring their feet together quickly and they explode. I don't know. When I see that, I say, that just looks right to me. You know, more than coming down left, right, you know. Because I liken it this way. If I'm on the right side of the court and I'm dribbling down, then I tell my brain, okay, I want to shoot it, and my right foot is forward, I now need to go left, right, and pull up and shot. If I was a hop shooter and my right foot's forward, I scissor them together and I'm up instantly, you know, with a step sooner. And I feel like, you know, there might be some trade-offs on the other end with hop. Like people talk about, you can't really step back if you're a hop shooter, which doesn't really make sense to me. But, you know, those are the things I start to see. And when we're going to do a big project this summer where we start to compare hop versus the 1-2 and rhythmically. And maybe you never know. Maybe they'll come to the thing where, listen, hop shooters are shooting better than 1-2 guys. Would you ever change if that was evidence to that fact?
I'm always open to change when I can find a better way to do what we do within the parameters of our philosophy. And certainly that would be one of those things. You know, we didn't use the ball screen at all in our offense, and now we do incorporate the ball screen quite a bit because it's such an integral part of today's game. and obviously create so many scoring options. So we're always open to change, and I would love to hear your results from that study.
You know, it's funny because I'm not as adamant about the hop as people might think. I've now developed an idea, what I've been really, because I really study this stuff. Like when people watch the games, they might be looking at offense or whatever. I do everything, and I go down frame by frame to watch the jump shooters. And what I think I've come up with now, I'll throw this out there as we end, is that let's on a pin down on the left side of the floor for a right-handed shooter, I think it has to be a 1-2, but it would have to be because you need the left foot to anchor yourself to get a turn. By the way, I don't know if you noticed, we talk about the turn as well, where we don't shoot 10 toes to the rim. Have you ever heard of that?
I agree with that very much. I think that most shooters are turn shooters.
Beautiful. Because sometimes guys think I'm crazy when I talk about it, especially guys who are a little bit older. But I'm glad that you recognize that. So the point being that you can't hop and get that turn and get your elbow and your shoulder aligned very easily. So I'm starting to think now, if I was going to teach and run a program now, I would be, on the left side for righties, 1-2. And on the right side, it's already leading that way. It's a simple, a quick hop and you're off. So I totally see the difference between like the situations and why it does it. Whenever I've asked NBA guys about the hop and the 1-2, like guys like Kyle Korver, who hop a lot, they 1-2 a lot, they'll tell you it's situational, but then they don't always know what the situation is, right? They just kind of like say it and they shrug. So my whole take on it is I think good shooters should know. Like Ray Allen, maybe, I don't know if he knew when I asked him, but he always hops on his flare cuts to the right baseline. Right, he's flaring, getting like a hammer screen, and he hops. And you couldn't really 1-2 because it's coming the other direction, right? You have to almost hop. And so, to me, if I was working out in the summers, why would I ever 1-2 that shot, right? Anyway, I got off on my little tangent on the shooting, but I feel like we need more of a focus on that kind of thing and understanding the real techniques of the footwork, like shots in the golf bag, right? You should know that I always 1-2 on this shot, I always hop on this shot. And I feel like we need to get that dialogue going.
I think that's very, very interesting. We do want all perimeter shots we want to plant step on, and we work on doing that, and I think that's the key to where it becomes a very comfortable thing for your players to do. And again, for us, I mentioned that our first anchor for our team is sureness, taking care of the ball. Our second anchor is working to get great shots. So we're in a little bit different scenario than an NBA team is from the standpoint of you're going to take pressured shots. You have to. Every shot's not going to be an open shot. You're not going to be able to get open shots against the defenses that you're going to see at that level, the athleticism, the quickness, what you have, particularly in a 24-second shot clock. And so much of that game is done off the dribble, although who couldn't love watching Golden State and how much they were able to score with cuts off of the ball as opposed to only on-ball stuff. Again, Nick, I think it's what makes our game great. I think the biggest thing that you hit on there, which I am totally 100% behind, is that we teach the fundamentals of the game and what we do. And sometimes we get too lost in the X's and O's as opposed to teaching teams how to catch, how to shoot, how to dribble, how to pass. And those things are of just as much, if not more, importance.
Absolutely. Well, Coach, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on the show. Maybe we'll have to have it come on and we'll talk even more because it sounds like there's a lot more we can go through in more detail. But don't forget, sports fans, at B-Ball Breakdown, we're not a channel, we're a conversation. You in? Are you in, Coach?
I'm in.